You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London. This is The Globalist and I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, all eyes are on Geneva, where the world's two biggest nuclear powers, the US and Russia, are set to meet. We'll look towards the summit on Wednesday and ask what Putin and Biden want to achieve from the encounter. Then...
We had a positive and productive meeting. Our two countries have big agendas. Our teams are going to continue our discussions and I'm confident we'll make real progress with Turkey and the United States.
We'll get the detail on a meeting between Biden and the Turkish leader Erdogan before crossing to Spain, where the proposed pardon of 12 Catalan separatist leaders has caused mass protests. Plus...
America is back. America is back.
Author Edward Isaac de Vere tells us about his book charting the internal workings of the US Democrat Party over the last 15 years and how Biden can now announce the return of the US to the global stage with such confidence. We'll join our man in the Balkans for a roundup of stories from the region, and then we'll examine the row between diners and drivers in Rome as cafes encroach on the curbs. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. NATO leaders have agreed to adopt a tough new position on China following Joe Biden's first summit with the alliance. Australia and the United Kingdom have agreed the terms of a new trade deal, the first post-Brexit pact negotiated from scratch for Britain. And the European Union and the United States look set to end a 17-year dispute over aircraft subsidies. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, on Wednesday, the world's two biggest nuclear powers, the US and Russia, come together in Geneva as the city hosts a summit between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin. Well, joining me is Stephen Diel, who's a Russia analyst and regular Monocle 24 contributor, and Benno Zog, regular contributor too here and a researcher at ETH in Zurich. Welcome to the studio. Welcome back, Stephen.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could set the political scene for us. I mean, this meeting comes at a particularly tense time for relations between Russia and the US.
It does indeed. Some diplomats are even saying that relations now are worse than they were during the Cold War, and it's quite difficult to argue with that, actually. So, yes, they're probably as bad as they've ever been, relations between Russia and the United States. But I think this shows tremendous maturity on the part of Biden, because basically he's said, let's have this meeting. And he's been criticised in his own country for doing so, because... other Americans are saying, well, what's Russia done? Russia's attacking us in cyber. Russia's it's invaded Ukraine. It's shown no remorse for anything it's done. It's tried to kill Navalny. Why should we reach out, if not the hand of friendship, at least the offer of a meeting to President Putin? And I think that President Biden is saying, well, if there's no dialogue, then the situation can only get worse and can only get more dangerous. So let's at least sit down and talk about our differences. And even if we agree to disagree or come away with no real positives, the actual fact that a meeting is taking place shows that dialogue can still go on.
Yeah. Benno, let's bring you in here and get some geographical scene setting too. Why is this taking place in Geneva and how important is it for the city?
Indeed, there's plenty of reasons that actually speak for Geneva to be host of this summit. And I emphasize host because Switzerland is in no way party. It's not at the table. It's not listening to the conversation. So it is really providing venue, security, and so on. The Swiss foreign minister went out of his way to actually offer to Putin, to Biden, this venue for the summit. And it's certainly also a coup for Swiss diplomacy to once have this very high-level summit again. And it reminds everyone of the 1985 summit between Ronald Reagan and new Soviet leader Gorbachev at the time. There's a few very, very pragmatic and tangible reasons to speak for Geneva. It's the European seat of the United Nations as well as dozens of other international organizations. So it's used to hosting exactly these kind of summit. Plus, it's conveniently located in the center of Europe, can easily be reached from all sides. And I guess Switzerland and Geneva as well have a good reputation with Putin and Biden themselves as well. That makes it one of the most neutral grounds where you can meet to have this summit that is in and of itself already very political. At least the venue is neutral, if you will.
Stephen, what's the goal of the summit as far as Putin is concerned, and how will he approach it?
In some ways, he's already achieved his main goal by having a meeting which shows he can go back home and show, look, America asked for a meeting with us. You know, we are on a par. This is it's very difficult to overemphasize Putin's resentment about the way the world sees Russia, never mind about the way Russia sees the world. One of the things he's always been keen to do is to show that despite the collapse of the Soviet Union, when, of course, it was generally accepted there were two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union and post-Soviet Union Russia became almost a non-entity, and it was chaotic in the 90s, and then Putin came, and Putin has tried to build up its reputation. So Putin wants his country to be seen as a major player on the world stage. And being invited to a summit by the American president is a sign for him that we've achieved that. You know, we're back. Beyond that, I mean, they say that there are things that will be discussed. They will discuss nuclear agreements on numbers of missiles, which, of course, those have rather lapsed in recent years. They'll discuss regional issues such as Syria and Iraq. They'll discuss climate change, undoubtedly. There will, of course, also be, from President Biden's side, questions about Russia's human rights record. Putin, to be honest, doesn't care about that. He's just going to brush that aside. He's going to come back with lots of whataboutism. Well, he's already been asked about this in an interview with NBC. When asked about Russia's record on human rights and imprisoning Navalny, they said, well, you're just as bad in America because you've gone after these people who attack the White House, who see you're going after people for their political beliefs, which is nonsense, but it's a typical bit of Russian whataboutism, and there'll be more of that. But basically, as far as Putin's concerned, he's already got the tick in the box because the meeting's taking place.
And Benno, I mean, since the last time the leaders of the US met, Russia seems to have become more authoritarian, possibly emboldened by Donald Trump. I wonder how that might change the tone of the meeting.
That certainly isn't ideal. Also, that in the past weeks, even, we've seen this tightening of repression against Navalny's political organization, for example. That doesn't bode well for this kind of summit. And Biden is under a lot of pressure to actually speak firmly and strongly at Putin about these things. And I'm a bit afraid that this will end up in monologues of each side listing their grievances, their issues, without actual dialogue happening. But certainly this has changed the scene a bit and made it even more tense. But on the other hand, this makes diplomacy and these kind of meetings all the more important, that the two have some kind of understanding of each other. And if we're optimistic that such a summit can trigger further processes, diplomats, experts, ministers sitting down and actually trying to come up with actual proposals, with tangible agendas, working on nuclear issues and so on, because there's the list of potential fields of cooperation is sadly much shorter than the list of disagreements. So it really needs further processes, further interactions to create what Biden is expecting, which is to have a bit more predictability and stability in the relations between the two. That is not very much, but if we're talking about the biggest nuclear powers in the world, that's already quite ambitious given current environment.
Yeah. Stephen?
Yeah, those are very good points that Benno makes. And it just struck me that perhaps one seemingly small but nevertheless significant outcome of this could be that each country could have the other country's ambassador back in it. Both Russia and the United States have recalled their ambassador for discussions, which, of course, is always a sign that diplomatic relations are bad between countries. And so if as a result of this meeting, as a result of the two presidents talking, they each decided and agreed that they would send their ambassador back to the embassy where they should be, where that's what their job is. That would be seen as a significant achievement.
Are there any other? I mean, Benno said the list of potential agreements is short, but what would those be?
Well, climate change, I mentioned earlier, is something they can talk about, and that's I was going to say non-political, but nothing with them is non-political, but it's less political than issues of, say, human rights. So if they can come to some sort of agreement to carry on talking about climate change, because Russia's record on climate change is pretty poor. Russia has a bad record of oil spills and of all sorts of problems which add to climate change issues. So that would be one, and that's possibly because that's less political than, say, the nuclear missiles or human rights. That's possibly one where, again, if they can come out and say, well, you know, we've agreed, we're going to keep talking on that, again, that's another tick in the box.
Yeah. And Benno, how important is this meeting internationally? I mean, obviously, given that it involves the two greatest nuclear powers, and as Stephen says, I mean, climate change is going to impact on us all.
It's certainly very, very closely watched, which is a bit dangerous as well, because then expectations may be overestimated or maybe too high. Because what can this one summit even deliver when there's not a single specific proposal on the table? The two cannot even agree on anything in particular. So tangible results will be short. There will not even be a joint press conference afterwards. That says quite a lot. They're not even having a joint meal, for example, where they can get to know each other at the more personal level. So that's certainly quite tricky. But it will be closely watched in Europe in particular. And I think it's very important, the order of Biden's agenda on this one-week trip that is on. First, meet the allies in various settings. Reassure Ukraine, for example. He had a phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, because Ukraine is obviously watching as well. Will its territorial integrity be some part of some kind of superpower deal, like in the past, without having a say in it? But Biden has made it very clear, allies first. He is keen on fostering an alliance of democracy against authoritarian states. So this reassurance, I think, has really reached its audience. So with a little more ease to Geneva tomorrow.
And finally, Stephen, how is this playing in the Russian media?
They see it as this triumph that Putin has been recognised by Biden, by America, but they're not holding out any great hopes. I think more important than the Russian media have been certain Russian think tanks. There are some very wise voices in Moscow who tend to come out in think tanks because they can be a bit more free than the media can be. And they have suggested that actually this is something that will be seen as progress in very dark times. So no one's really holding their breath as to what's going to happen. And as Benno was saying as well, it's, you know, there's an awful lot of expectation around the world, but I think in Russia and in America, there's probably where there's the least expectation. No Russian media or Russian think tank is saying, oh, there's going to be a breakthrough. No, they're going to say, well, at least they're talking. That's as good as it's going to get.
Stephen Diehl and Benno Zog from Zurich, thank you both very much. And our contributor Florian Egli will be in Geneva tomorrow for the summit. So do stay tuned for check-ins on all of Monocle 24's live news shows. And Stephen himself will be back on Wednesday's briefing to unpack the day so far. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and US President Joe Biden have known each other for years, but yesterday was the first time they've met as sitting heads of government. Monday's hour-long session took place on the sidelines of the NATO summit and was described by both men in very positive terms. Hannah Lucinda Smith is the Istanbul correspondent for the Times newspaper, and she joins me from the city now. Hannah, despite the good vibes, the relationship between the two hasn't always been easy. What's their history?
Yeah, well, it goes back to the Obama era. So, yeah, obviously Biden was part of the Obama team that was dealing with Erdogan as that relationship between Turkey and the US really started to fall apart from about 2013 onwards. It mainly fell apart due to Syria. Erdogan saw the US's kind of gradual backing out of support for the rebels in Syria as something of a betrayal. And then that was compounded by the fact that the US then threw its support behind Kurdish factions in Syria. So he was there at the time that relationship really, really fell apart. Obviously, in the Trump era, that relationship became even more messy still. We saw Turkey moving closer to Russia in that period. And now Biden takes the helm with a whole host of issues with Turkey on his plate.
Yeah, absolutely. So much to discuss. I mean, for instance, the US support to Syrian Kurdish armed groups still exists. I mean, that's still a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's quite telling that in the Turkish press today, one of the points that is made again and again is that Erdogan raised this with Biden. I mean, Erdogan really wants to kind of give the impression that he's being tough on the US about this, because it's one of these issues that is really kind of goes across political lines in Turkey. You'd be very, very hard pushed to find anyone in Turkey, no matter what part of the political spectrum they're on, whether they support Erdogan or not, who is not, you know, quite, you know, excited about the fact that the US is supporting a group in Syria that is widely considered a terrorist group in Turkey. Mm. So that's one of the issues. Another, of course, is the S-400, which is Turkey's purchase of the Russian missile defense system, which brought down US sanctions and has seen Turkey kicked out of the F-35 program. Quite significantly, there doesn't seem to have been any progress on that issue at all.
And that's a big problem for NATO. How does Turkey see its role in NATO going forward? And what specific plans are there for Turkish NATO involvement?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the things that has been raised again and again in recent years is, you know, is Turkey about to leave NATO or is NATO about to kick Turkey out? Neither of those things are going to happen. You know, for NATO, Turkey is in this hugely strategic position. It's a bulwark against Russia. It's obviously right on the borders of Iran and what's happening in Syria and Iraq as well. And also for Turkey, you know, even though Erdogan has been moving closer to Putin over the past 5 years, I mean, you know, Russia and Turkey are geographic rivals. They have rivals in all kinds of areas and, you know, have never fought on the same side in any war in modern history. And NATO is just as vital for Turkey as Turkey is for NATO. And I think it was quite significant looking at the communique that NATO put out after the summit yesterday. There were several references to Turkey about, you know, Turkey being an important ally. There's also talk of, let's say, commitment to boosting assurance measures in Turkey. And also there's going to be a maritime security center of excellence opened in Turkey. So really, I think a reaffirmation from the alliance of the important role that Turkey plays.
Mm. Now, we know, of course, that Turkey's economy is in a very bad state. Have these meetings had any impact on the value of the Turkish lira?
Yeah, well, I mean, the main reason why Erdogan went into this meeting with Biden saying that he wanted a positive agenda and to turn a new page in relation to the US is the absolute dire state of the Turkish economy. The Turkish lira has hit record lows recently. Foreign investors are pulling out. And I think, you know, he wanted to come out of that meeting with something that he could sort of wave in front of investors to say, look, everything's on track. We're normalizing relations. We're a strong ally, and try and tempt some of that capital back into Turkey. Now, it's had, let's say, a limited effect. The lira's strengthened slightly, but certainly, you know, nothing like a kind of bounce back. You know, there's still a sort of looming foreign debt problem. And I think it will take a lot more than this to really assure investors that Turkey is getting back to a place where it's a safe investment bet.
Hanna Lucinda Smith in Istanbul. Thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll look through the papers, get a news wrap from the Balkans, and delve into the drivers versus diners row in Italy. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
With his current tour, Joe Biden is very publicly demonstrating that America is back. Today, we speak to an author who's followed Democratic politics for 15 years, closely monitoring that journey. Edward Isaac de Vere is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His new book is called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaign to Defeat Trump. And he joins us from Washington, D.C. Edward Isaac, thanks so much for making the time to speak to us. How did the Democrats manage to win the presidency, especially after the longest primary race and the biggest field ever?
Well, thanks for having me. I think the answer to your question is that it was just barely. This is a book that ended up topping out at about 500 pages, and there could have been lots of other stories and pages that were written for it, through all the twists and turns, but this was not an easy path back for Democrats, and it presents them, even though they had a good result in the end with Biden defeating Trump, it was not the kind of result and not the size of margin that they were hoping for and that they thought would be theirs, especially given how much energy there was, it seemed, against Donald Trump and all of that accentuated by his handling of the pandemic.
And so what about the struggles within the party itself? I mean, have they stayed united? There's been internal struggles between newly empowered progressives and establishment forces. And of course, as you say, with the pandemic, with the economic crisis and the whole new racial reckoning in the background.
Well, it's all those things and much more. I was reporting on the goings-on of the Democratic Party day to day for my day job, and there's so much in this book that I did not know had been happening until I started reporting it over for the book. And you see how there was both alliances that were being formed with the common enemy of getting Donald Trump out of the White House, and at the same time, fissures that were opening or being barely papered over that now you see with them, with the Democrats in power, a totally different approach, of course, because Donald Trump's not there anymore. There's not an election in front of them anymore. And now they've gotten through the first couple of months of COVID relief and getting past the horrors of the riot and everything else that was going on after the election. And now it's, can you actually have a governing agenda? Can you do things like infrastructure, big things that Democrats say they all believe in? But of course, saying you believe in something is different from figuring out what that actually looks like when it comes to legislation.
So what is their strategy now for a return to the world stage?
Well, the big question in terms of international relations is whether what Donald Trump represented is the future of America and the future of America's involvement in global affairs, or whether Joe Biden's election, showing that we're hopefully in his mind that it'll be a turn back to where things were before Trump, that that's where things were and that Trump was the aberration. We don't know which one is the answer. It's going to take some time for that to play out in terms of domestic politics, but certainly where Joe Biden is aiming for in this first trip, going from the G7 to NATO to what will, it seems like, be deliberately a confrontational conversation with Vladimir Putin, is saying that everything that was going on for the last 4 years is done.
And of course, though, nobody can trust that completely. NATO knows that 4 years goes past very fast.
Indeed. And we just don't know what the future of American politics holds and whether there is a resurgent Trumpism or even a resurgent Trump that's coming. Joe Biden would like to have people believe that, as he keeps saying, America is back, America is back. But it may be that he's the last vestige of what America was and Donald Trump is what the future is. Or it may be that that, in fact, Biden's right. Or it may be something alternative, some path between the two of them.
What do you personally believe?
I think we don't know. We see a country in America that is going through a lot of turmoil. In this book, it's called Battle for the Soul. That imagery is drawn from a phrase that Biden used a lot, but I think it's very much on point with where we are and with what I tried to document in the book. There's a lot that is going on in America that is a constant churn and is obviously erupted in some violence along the way. It's unclear whether America is going through adolescence or a midlife crisis or the first stages of decline.
And in terms of unity within the party, is that working? Can there be a cohesive approach?
We haven't yet seen how it's played out except for around the COVID relief legislation. So there is a huge push now for infrastructure is the next big thing, one of the biggest spending packages in American history if Joe Biden gets his way. But can he unite the people who want there to be lots of priorities built into that, like childcare as part of infrastructure and climate change regulations as part of infrastructure, along with those people who are more rightward leaning and opposed to bigger government spending and bigger government intervention, even within the Democratic Party? That's what we're going to see tested over these next couple of weeks.
And of course, the book doesn't take in this current trip of Biden's, but watching it from DC, what are your conclusions about how he's changing the conversation about America and its domestic and foreign policy?
We all got used to seeing those images of Donald Trump at any of these meetings of foreign leaders, pushing himself to the front or having very confrontational conversations with allies, with Angela Merkel or with others. That's obviously not the imagery that we're seeing out of this. It's very much on purpose. You see, whether it's Boris Johnson or Emmanuel Macron, making very complimentary comments about Joe Biden. And in the book, there is one of the first scenes that's reported in the book is the last meeting that Barack Obama had with Vladimir Putin about the election interference in 2016 and the hacking that was going on. And there's some previously unreported details about Obama threatening consequences on Putin. And that obviously was not the kind of conversation that Donald Trump had been having with Vladimir Putin over these 4 years. And even over the last couple of weeks, Trump put out a statement saying that he trusts Putin more than he trusts American intelligence. That's a stunning statement in itself for a president or former president of the United States. And Joe Biden is very much creating a demarcating line between that and what he hopes is anything else about American policy.
And so do you think we'll finally find out then from Putin, will he repeat whatever it was he said to Donald Trump in Helsinki, which so clearly had an impact on Trump?
Well, he may say it, but one of the things that we're going to see that will be very different is that Helsinki, obviously, there was a press conference with Putin and Trump both attending. Biden will do a press conference after his meeting with Putin. The meeting will be behind closed doors, and Putin will not be at that press conference. So Biden will not be in a position where he'll have to answer for Putin in real time, or that Putin will be able to put his own comments in the same way. That in itself is a decision not to elevate Putin to the same level as the American president, which is something that Donald Trump had been willing to do. Biden and his staff have made. That's a kind of decision that's theatrics, but speaks to something more than theatrics. And so they have made it so that Putin will not have equal time or equal share and will not be able to say things like what got Donald Trump into trouble when he ended up agreeing with what Vladimir Putin had said about the election interference.
Isaac, thank you very much indeed. That was Edward Isaac de Vere, and his new book is called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaign to Defeat Trump. Now, coming up, we cross to Spain, but first, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. NATO leaders have agreed to adopt a tough new position on China following Joe Biden's first summit with the alliance. A final communique states that Beijing's actions pose systemic changes to the rules-based international order. The new approach marks a shift for NATO, which was created to defend Europe during the Cold War. Australia and the United Kingdom have agreed the terms of a new trade deal, the first post-Brexit pact negotiated from scratch for Britain. Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Scott Morrison agreed to the final points in the deal over dinner at Downing Street on Monday. The agreement would see an end to tariffs on whisky, cars and clothing.
And the European Union and the United States look set to end a 17-year dispute over aircraft subsidies. Officials announced the sides are close to signing the deal on subsidy rules for Boeing and Airbus after 2 days of negotiations in Brussels. The agreement could see an end to the billions of dollars in tariffs imposed on goods going between the bloc and the US every year. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Catalonia, the semi-autonomous region of Spain, caused a huge political crisis in the country with an illegal independence referendum in 2017. 2 years later, 9 Catalan leaders were jailed for their role, and another 3 were found guilty of disobedience but not incarcerated. The government now plans to pardon the 12, sparking huge protests in Madrid on Sunday. Well, joining me on the line is Dr. Pablo Calderón Martínez, lecturer in politics and international relations at the New College of the Humanities. Pablo, thanks for joining us. Why are these men being pardoned or being considered to be pardoned?
Hello, good morning. Yes, I think that's a very interesting question, and I think it's all part of political calculation, really, from the government. And obviously, the socialist government in Spain, the national government, is propped up by other regional parties and by left-wing parties in the Spanish Congress. So this really is a political calculation and very much is in line with what has happened recently in Spanish politics and how the socialist government really is relying on the handling of the regions and the handling of regionalism in Spain to sort of maintain its position in power. And again, I think the events, particularly the huge march that we've seen in the recent days, it strengthens the Socialist Party position as the party that can actually deal with this sort of, with the Catalonian crisis and separatism in Spain. And yeah, I think it's all part of a political calculation, a risky one, no doubt, but I think it's all part of the plan from the socialist government to establish itself as a party and as the actor that can really bring Spain together somehow.
And how is the government publicly justifying the move? Is that their line?
Yeah, I think that's a line. I think Sanchez is trying to portray the image that he's the one that is going to reconcile Spain and he's the one that wants to bring Spain together. And it's about moving forward. And obviously, this is very, very problematic in certain parts of Spain, the parts of Spain that are more conservative, perhaps, and that are more Spanish, if that makes any sense. And this plays very, very difficult in those particular areas. But then again, the Socialist Party has not been performing very well in those areas anyways. And it plays to the advantage of the Socialist Party, in my view, more than what the Socialist Party is doing and what the government of Sanchez is doing, how the right is reacting to this move. And it doesn't play very well and is not very comforting in certain areas and for many, many people, to see the more traditional center-right party, the Popular Party, so closely aligned with far-right parties like Vox when it comes to the reaction to these measures, if you see what I'm saying. So it's a little bit of a game they're playing. And I think in this particular instance, it's playing more in the favor of the socialist government than their right-wing opposition.
So let's just look at these protests. Who's protesting?
It's a very wide coalition, but in reality is... And again, the Popular Party has a very difficult game to play because obviously they're very much against any more power given to the regions and particularly to Catalonia. And they want to be seen as having a stronger line with Catalonia. But they also don't want to be aligned with the far right of Vox. And there is, as it were, and I was listening to your previous interviewee, a battle for the soul of the right in Spain between the more traditional center-right and the Popular Party, and even the more extreme elements within the Popular Party that have always been there. And it's really much a coalition from people from the center-right, more traditional right-wing Spanish to more extreme views of the Spanish right. And I think the problem is that it's all becoming part of the same political party, political spectrum. And this is very, very problematic for Spain, and in particular for the right, which is going to make it more or less unelectable, really.
Mm. How strong, then, is the independence movement still in Catalonia?
That's a very interesting question. It's very hard to measure as well, because obviously the COVID pandemic has put a dampening in the mood, of course. There hasn't been any real push, and Spain had to obviously deal with a very, very strong outbreak of COVID, and it's very hard to measure. For what I gather, it's falling back a little bit. Okay, I think the socialist government, again, the change from the Popular Party to the socialist government helped to ease some of the tensions. I think this move of pardoning some of the leaders of the process is going to ease the tensions even further. And I think a lot of people in Catalonia are thinking that it's about time to start moving forward. But this problem in Catalonia is something that comes up every few years, right? Every 3 years, when there's a particular political crisis or an economic crisis, the issue of independence raises again. So I think we're going to perhaps to a valley or plateau, sort of the wave is coming down, and there's going to be a process, a time of calm, and this is going to go up again whenever we have a next political crisis, economic crisis, whatever you want to say.
Dr. Pablo Calderon Martinez, thank you very much for joining us. Listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me is Agnès Poirier from France. Agnès, welcome to you. The streets of France have become a giant cafe terrace. It sounds fabulous, is it?
Well, it is, for at least for the moment. That's what the editorial by Vincent Trémollet in Le Figaro is saying today. It has a lovely title in French, La France s'étourdit. France is getting dizzy. And he says, you know, one of the things he says in his editorial, private joys forbidden for too long have taken over public fears. We are rediscovering others' faces. It's a precious yet fleeting moment that we're living, because of course we have the first round of the regional elections this Sunday. I'm sure we'll be talking about it later, but he says we can't, however, postpone facing realities much longer. But still, it's quite extraordinary when you walk in the streets of Paris, especially in the evening, because the curfew now has been postponed to 11 p.m. So the last week, it's actually difficult to walk on you know, the pavements or even the streets, because there are tables and tables everywhere, tables and chairs everywhere. And also in the last week, we've been able to go to terraces, but also to go to the restaurant indoors. And there have been some giant soirée parties, wild parties, with a lot of young people who just need this catharsis, this release, in different parts of Paris, but indeed in different cities in France, where the police had to evacuate at 2 a.m., you know, long gone the curfew, and sometimes to use tear gas because they just wouldn't leave. And of course, they were not socially distancing, but the temperatures have been so high. You know, it's 30 degrees in Paris today, and the end of exams for certain students and the beginning of summer.
What are the latest COVID figures and the vaccination rate there at the moment?
Well, probably it's linked, you know, because the figures are very good. We have currently 2,000 patients in intensive care against more than 8,000 just a couple of months ago at the peak of the third wave. The vaccination for teenagers, any children from the age of 12, is starting today. So far, 46% of the French population has received at least one jab, and 22% is fully vaccinated. And we learned yesterday that mask wearing may be lifted from the 1st of July, because don't forget that the French have had to wear a mask indoors and outdoors for almost a year now.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking about students and, of course, exam season and wild parties. Le Monde has a story about the baccalaureate returning.
Yes, absolutely, because last year, of course, all the exams were cancelled. It was a decision that was wisely taken pretty early on. I mean, if you compare with the British A-levels and exams fiasco of last summer, well, at least in France, as early as April, it was decided there would be no exams and that the marks and the baccalaureate would be given on a sort of yearly assessment from the teachers. Of course, it gave way to grade inflation, and 95% of 18-year-olds in France got their baccalaureate. So this year, they are sitting exams, so it's a nice thing in a way. And they are going to start on Thursday with the traditional first exams for everyone, which is the philosophy exam. Let me give you a few examples of what they have to write in their dissertation about, what they have to ponder and meditate. For instance, is morality the best of policies? Does labor divide people? Is it possible to suspend time? And what's the point of art? It was the latest, it was the 2019 topics that were given. But some French teachers say, because they are, you know, never a very happy bunch, they think that sitting exams is more egalitarian than leaving it to schools to assess students, because this year there will be a bit of both. Students have had such a disrupted last 18 months that there will be sitting exams, but some topics will be assessed on their annual marks, and French teachers would rather see them all, a whole generation, sitting exams because they think it's more egalitarian.
You mentioned the elections briefly. Let's talk about that. There's a big piece in Libération.
Oh, yes, it's the front cover of Libération. They have the very interesting survey from the Vivace Institute, and it's about the French. And basically, we could summarize by to vote or not to vote, because, you know, the French are quite politically engaged. And indeed, this survey confirms these views. Only 16% of the French say they are not interested in politics. And, you know, usually the turnout is pretty high in France compared to other countries in presidential elections. It's usually in the 80% and more. But not so much for regional or local elections, and of course we'll mention COVID and the weather, the great weather, when low turnout figures are published during the day on Sunday. But it is feared the turnout will be very high. And why? Well, because a lot of French people feel, you know, more and more disconnected with their politicians. 44% of them say that different manifestos or propositions by the politicians are not meeting their expectations. And more, a third of them, 34%, say that they agree that not to vote is actually a political option. So we'll see on Sunday. But of course, this will benefit the extremes, you know, and the National Front. This is always the case, that a low turnout is only good news for the political extremes.
Agnès, thank you very much indeed. Have a lovely day in the sun in Paris. That was Agnès Poirier, and this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, now let's get some news from the Balkans. And our correspondent there is Guy Delaunay, also known for his chat and a hat. Guy, we have to know, first of all, what is on your head this morning?
Not a lot at the moment because I'm still indoors. And who wears a hat indoors, Georgina? But if the sun is shining, I think one of my straw hats might be just the thing for this morning to keep things cool.
All right. Well, you're still indoors and you're going through the papers there. And Serbia-Kosovo talks have resumed in Brussels. What's your prognosis for that?
Well, it's not looking good, to be honest with you. This, as regular listeners might recall, is something which happens every now and again, that the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo meet in Brussels for this so-called normalisation dialogue, which is the EU basically referees this. And it's been incredibly stop-start for the last few years. So there've been little bursts of meetings, then long breaks as governments change in one country or another. One country or another's holding elections. And it's been very, very bitty indeed. And people also make great domestic political points out of this. So you'll have people saying, we're not going to compromise. They're playing to their base constituencies. And as a result, you get no progress between Serbia and Kosovo treating each other in any kind of normal way.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on and talk about population in Croatia, because it seems that there's a big depopulation problem. But this is affecting house prices. In fact, there's great deals to be had.
There are indeed. I mean, we've heard about houses for £1 in Liverpool, houses for €1 in parts of Italy. Well, in one place in Croatia called Legrad, which is on the Hungarian border, you can get a house for a kuna. Now, there are about 8 kunas to the British pound. So it's pretty cheap, that. About 12 pence, I think that works out as. And the reason for this is Legrad has only got a couple of thousand people left in it. It once said that it was one of the largest population centres in Croatia. That's not a claim I've been able to verify, but it really is now, like many places in Croatia, struggling for people to live there. And not just that, but this birth rate replacement that everywhere needs. So they're trying to get young people to come in. If you're under 40, financially stable, and you're going to commit to staying 15 years in Legrad, you can have a house for a kuna, but you'll have to do it up a bit.
Well, and do it up quite a lot. I mean, most of the houses are abandoned, aren't they? And they need serious work.
Well, I've seen some video of this. Some of them do indeed need extremely serious work. Some of them are semi-finished building projects, which never really got much beyond the walls. Some of them are houses which have fallen into disrepair, where they've basically been abandoned over the years. But some people have already been taking advantage of it. Of the 19 houses which were initially put on offer, 17 of them have been snapped up, and at least one resident is already saying, yes, he's very happy to be there. He's much happier to be an owner in Legrad than a tenant somewhere else.
Mm. And of course, Legrad isn't the only place in Croatia that's suffering from depopulation.
No, that's right. About three quarters of the cities and towns in Croatia, according to a recent survey, have fewer people than they should do. And this is in order for them to sort of work economically and for them basically to be prosperous places. And if you look at the population in Croatia as a whole, it's lost, and it's difficult to put a precise figure on this, but hundreds of thousands of people since it joined the European Union in 2013. And that's, if you think about a country with a population of 4 million to start with, you can't afford to lose hundreds of thousands of people. And they've gone from pretty much everywhere apart from the capital, Zagreb. Zagreb's population stays more or less stable at around 800,000. Everywhere else, and some places desperately so, have been losing people. So Croatia really needs to do something to sort this out.
Mm. Now we're going to a story which looks very much to me like one of those dodgy ads you see on Instagram. Tell us about the sea air mask.
Yeah, we're all getting a bit fed up of wearing face masks. I hate to wee people, Georgina, but, it is a bit boring sticking on a mask every time you go into a shop or something, isn't it? So in Croatia, there is a company that's come up with this wheeze that you can have a mask infused with sea air. And this company's called Saltant Checker. And what they've done is they've actually taken crystals of salt from the Adriatic Sea, and Croatia, of course, has got a very long stretch of Adriatic coast, and it's put these crystals in between the layers of these masks, which are disposable, I'm sorry to say, but you can put them on and breathe in the sea air. And they said they were going to do this even before the pandemic, that they wanted people to be able to breathe in the Adriatic wherever they went, and now they have a fresh purpose.
I would imagine that that would have extreme dehydrating effect on your skin. But yeah, anyway.
Well, you know, what can I say? I mean, they're saying that the salt, the sea salt is good for you, allegedly. Yeah. But scientifically untested, I think we can probably say.
Now, Guy, you have sent me the most terrifying video.
Did you like it?
No, it made me feel sick, I have to say. So, tell the listeners what it's about, but I would never do it in a million years.
So this is a swing in the Bosnian town of Mostar, but it's not just any swing. This is a swing on a cliff overlooking the city, and you sit in the swing, and somebody, presumably extremely foolish, because they're on the edge of a cliff, pushes you on your swing, and you fly out over the city, and there is nothing beneath you, really, apart from a lot of air. And it does look, indeed, from the video, absolutely petrifying. And this is part of Mostar. I think it's trying to be... If you've ever been to Queenstown in New Zealand, it sort of positions itself as the thrill capital of the world. I think Mostar's trying to do something similar, because they have this Fortica adventure park above the city. And this is one of the attractions, is this insane swing on a cliff edge. And, you know, among other things, you can, of course, jump off the bridge in Mostar. That's a famous thing to do. And they have one of those equally terrifying glass bridges, which, you know, seem to have a nasty habit of panes dropping out of them. They're not in Mostar, I hasten to add, yet.
Well, I would urge listeners to have a look at that video, because it is quite terrifying. Guy, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure. Finally, we're off to Rome. The sound of al fresco diners in the city, which can be heard around the Italian capital. But Rome is squaring up for a row between drivers and diners. As pandemic rules restrict indoor dining, cafes and restaurants have been granted permission to set up outdoor seating for free, encroaching on precious parking spaces in the city where the car is king. Megan Williams is a correspondent and longtime resident of Rome. She joins me now. Megan, can you describe the car culture in Rome? I mean, I understand it has one of the highest motorization rates in Europe.
That's right. It does. Italians in general and Romans as well do love their cars. Of course, during the pandemic, cars disappeared from the street, but it's amazing how quickly they've reappeared. Traffic is congested once again. In areas where there are shops and restaurants, you're seeing people double park, triple park, park at strange angles, park across pedestrian crosses. I mean, it's really right back to where it was before. It seems, despite the fact that the government tried to get people, it gave people eco bonuses to buy bicycles and these electric scooters, despite those efforts, Rome is back to the chaotic parking city that it's always been.
And I mean, of course, this comes with tremendous pollution, but the whole traffic issue and pollution have been on the agenda for some time. I mean, even pre-pandemic.
Well, they have. I mean, Rome and Milan and other major Italian cities are trying to do things like lay down more bike paths and get people, trying to improve the public transit. Now, the problem with Rome, apart from the fact that it still doesn't have many bike paths, I mean, elections are coming up, so I'm seeing a lot more paths are being improved. You know, that a lot of them had kind of degraded into being just parking lots for motorized bikes, but now they're being paved over and some have been added. But the big problem with Rome is that there are archaeological ruins all throughout the city. So every time they dig to extend the metro system, the subway system, they hit ruins. And so, it's a challenging city for public transit, apart from the fact that it's a city with a history of corruption and it's been poorly run. And so a lot of these public works projects go way over costs and take years and years to complete. Nonetheless, unlike most other major cities around the world, they're not sitting above these incredible ancient Roman ruins that people have to be careful about destroying when they go to build a subway system.
So back to pavement cafes. I mean, there was a rule change in April, which gave cafes the right to use extra space without having to pay for that. Now, that's obviously a boost for the catering economy, which is badly needed. How much space has been taken over and how are residents responding to it?
Well, there are about 10,000 restaurants and bar owners who have been granted these no-cost permits. Usually they cost about 14,000 euros. So just think of that. Now, a lot of that space is in piazzas and on sidewalks. Much of Rome has wide sidewalks. And of course, you know, Italy's famous for its wonderful public squares. So a lot of it is spilling over into that space that doesn't affect cars. But some of it is being built, what they call here in Italy, dehors, you know, the French word for outdoors space, these platforms that are taking up parking spots, which are already very precious for the residents. But, you know, in a way, Romans want it both ways. They tend to take their cars for short distances, so people are taking their cars to go to a restaurant, double, triple parking, taking up parking spots of local residents. And, you know, again, there just doesn't seem to have been many lessons from the pandemic, which is just keep your car at home. Get one of these. There are, you know, thousands of these electric scooters all over the place. But, you know, that's where the tension comes, is an unwillingness to change habits. And of course, there needs to be a lot more public transit too.
Absolutely. And just finally, I mean, have you seen any change in the dining habits of Romans? Because of course, eating out at all was banned for so long.
Oh, I mean, it's just incredible. The second the restaurants opened back up, they're full. You could not book anywhere. Indoor dining is now allowed as of the beginning of June. But you know, the weather's beautiful. People don't want to sit inside, even if they're socially distanced. So, I mean, on the upside, it's just amazing to walk through the city at night. There's just this, you know, the pent-up energy from the pandemic is just bursting forth. People of all ages, and that's the wonderful thing about Italy is, you know, the restaurants are crammed with young people, but they're also crammed with families sitting around, you know, toddlers and grandparents. And, you know, it's just incredible to see the outdoor city life around restaurants and bars and cafes just coming back to life in such an affirming way.
Absolutely, albeit choking on traffic fumes. Megan Williams in Rome, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds, Alexis Self, Daniel Bache and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Louis Allen. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and we'll be returning to Rome in Monocle Reads, where I speak to Andre Assaman, who's written extensively about the city. Of course, you'll remember him as the author of Call Me By Your Name. We'll also be taking you on a literary journey to Spain in Meet the Writers, where Rupert Thompson discusses his latest novel, Barcelona Dreaming. The briefing is live at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.